Hello and welcome to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Robert Johnson, a York Rite Mason and Knight Templar. So this week I figured we should focus on something that is very important, but not just to Freemasons. That is the actual practice of the seven liberal arts. Now, if you can't remember them, let's review. Grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. These can be broken down into two categories, the trivium, which is the base and holds grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and the quadrivium, which is arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now together those seven liberal arts form a 5-3-4 triangle. The five is your five senses. The three is the trivium, and the four, the quadrivium. Now the trivium is a system of thinking and leads one to truths, which have no basis in numbers, generally. It allows one to peel away layers until he finds truths. The quadrivium is all about numbers. Arithmetic, the number in itself. Geometry, numbers in space. Music, or harmonies or tuning theory, numbers in time. And astronomy, or cosmology, is the number in space and time. So you see how in just these seven arts, one can unlock anything. A great website for understanding the trivium, which is where you should start, is found on the Trivium Binder Project. It is run by Mr. Jarrett Sanchez. He is not a Freemason, but his work reflects Masonic tenets nonetheless. He has simply pulled articles and papers relevant to these teachings and has compiled them into a binder that you can even print out at home for free. It is presented in an order which allows you to understand it and reprogram yourself to use these things to solve problems and understand anything better. Of course, I don't mean to say you're going to brainwash yourself or anything of the sort. What I mean is it teaches you a way to look at things and ask better questions in order to get better answers. Grammar, logic, and of course, rhetoric. If you would like to check out this first step in the seven liberal arts, visit thetriviumbinder.blogspot.com. That's T-R-I-V-I-U-M, binder.blogspot.com. Mr. Jarrett Sanchez, the moderator, also has a neat podcast called The Next Step, which is quite enjoyable. While looking for a good quote to understand the difference between a traditional modern college academic career and the seven liberal arts, the Trivium Binder had a great quote on its front page by Ezra Loomis Pound, who was born in 1885 and died in 1972 and was a U.S. poet. He said, "Real education must ultimately be limited to men who insist on knowing. The rest is mere sheep herding." I believe this. I went to school. I have my degrees. But I can tell you, all I truly know, I didn't learn in school. What I did learn in school was how to pass tests based on a teacher's idea of what he felt was widely accepted as the truth. So I guess I have a good understanding of what is widely accepted as truth in a multitude of subjects. But why stop there? And for that matter, why start there? Education is good, but it is excellent when the student asks himself questions over and over again, and in different ways to extract the truth or full meaning to all aspects of life. Next week we'll focus on the quadrivium, which is the latter four of the seven liberal arts. The first piece I have is, in fact, right from the Trivium Binder, and it's just an excerpt called Summary of the Trivium. The Trivium, the first three of the seven liberal arts and sciences, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, are integrated as a method to train the mind to learn and think systematically. The Trivium can be called the art and science of the mind. The Quadrivium, the last four of the liberal arts and sciences, arithmetic, geometry, musical theory, and astronomy, study matter, which alone possesses extension in space. Mind does not possess the quality of extension that can be quantifiably measured. The quadrivium can be called the art and science of matter and measurement. From the human perspective, mind and matter form the total of reality. The work and effect of the trivium is yielding truth about the universe and ourselves. That is, knowledge, understanding, and wisdom are applied to realize either specific or universal truths. By practicing and applying the trivium, a strong sense of conviction in allowing the truth to surface is encountered, even in the face of adversity. When the truth is discovered, knowledge and understanding and wisdom will have been realized in reciprocity. We become independent students and thinkers. The mastery of any one of the three constituents of the trivium is not itself a sufficient goal. That is, mastery of grammar is not the goal in itself. Neither are mastery of logic nor rhetoric goals in themselves. It is best to compare the effectiveness of the trivium to a computer system. The computer's keyboard and mouse enter raw data discursively into a system to be processed. This is the computer's grammar. The central and auxiliary processors apply the appropriate reasoning procedures to differentiate or to integrate the raw data. This is the computer's logic. The monitor and printer display the conclusions of the processed data to yield usable information. This can be likened to the wisdom or rhetoric output of the computer. Any one of the three major components in the computer, the input processing and output device, is not necessarily useful by itself, but exceeding so as a whole system. The subjects of the trivium are to be learned separately, but in order to yield consistent truth, they must be applied as an integral method. It is a system, as is a computer. Ideally, the trivium will become an internalized automatic pattern of fundamental thinking. Picture the three subjects comprising individual nodes on a spiral structure leading up to the concept of truth as the uppermost fourth node. When using the methodical system in this configuration, one's thoughts shuttle back and forth, up and down, and in view of various pairs of nodes as mental connections are made in an attempt, or in the fact, of finding truth. However, the trivium method is also consistent with human error. The power of the trivium is such that if an error has been made in coming to an integral conclusion, the truth will eventually be surrendered if the method is consistently applied over time when new, more pertinent data is placed into the appropriate nodes of the structure. Much as each of the topics of the trivium can be applied independently, but to much better effect as integrated whole, so have these general modes been applied independently. Thus far, we have not yet learned to blend, integrate, and concretize the total power of technological work directed by an optimal ethic while coupled with the motivation of supreme imagination. Said in the mythopoeic tradition, to close the circle, we have not yet learned to harmonize the hand, the head, and the heart. Now again, that was just an excerpt from that whole paper, which you can read on the actual website if you'd like. That's triviumbinder.blogspot.com. Next would be our Grand Lodge Spotlight. However, I did receive word from my Grand Lodge, and all is well. They're totally okay with the podcast in general. But before doing any further spotlights, I need to contact each lodge prior. So that is what I'm doing. And until I get responses from some of them, I have to put the segment on hiatus, but I'll keep you all updated. A quick note, there is a new feature on the Facebook, and there is a tab that lets you listen to the show, which was made by the folks at Liberated Syndication. It will replace the old player on Facebook permanently. This new player is a Facebook app and is actually easier to manage for me anyway. And I think you guys should find it all cool too. And now there's going to be a new segment, which will be periodic, mostly when I have no Grand Lodge Spotlight.
Freemason Conspiracies.
So every now and again, I guess we will have some fun with this. This is a new one dated October of 2011, and it was from the Wall Street Journal, entitled Latest Freemason Conspiracy, Recruiting Younger Brothers, Ancient Order Resorts to Facebook, Co-ed Paintball and Ghost Stories, by Barry Newman. St. Paul, Minnesota, no self-respecting secret society, can get by without a Facebook fan page anymore. That's transparently true of the Freemasons, renowned for their medieval blood oaths, their often alleged plot to create a new world order, their locked-door conclaves of U.S. presidents and power brokers, and their boring pancake breakfasts, a menagerie of 19th-century civic and social brotherhoods and their attendant sisterhoods lives on around the globe. The Elks, the Moose, the Lions, the Oddfellows, Freemasonry is the oldest of all, still the biggest, and in the public mind, about as penetrable as the mythic crypt beneath the ninth vault of Solomon's Temple. Secrecy gives Masonry its mystique, yet the Masons have lately realized that they'd be lost in oblivion if it weren't for the web. I looked for pictures, Matt Gallagher was saying, of his internet search for a Masonic lodge worth joining. I really wanted to avoid a bunch of 80-year-olds. It was Thursday evening, almost time for fellowship night at the very young lodge he finally did join, Braden number 168, housed on a shady street in a column temple the Masons built in 1910. Mr. Gallagher is 32 years old and between jobs. He was initiated in Braden in 2009, rose to Master Mason, and is now a Lodge Education Officer. It's a post that didn't exist for 290 years after Masonry came out of its historical shadows in 1717 as a London club for enlightened gentlemen. Mr. Gallagher's Masonic tag, if his digital function had one, might be Worshipful Webmaster. I started a blog, Facebook, Flickr, he said, descending a narrow stairway to a faded meeting room with its old pool tables and portraits of Brother George Washington. I wanted video essays on our site, he added. People need to know what they're getting into. Once a petitioner for Masonic membership didn't know what he was getting into until he had a hood over his head, a rope around his neck, and was swearing never to reveal the secret handshake. The handshake is still secret, but now there are so many hints and giveaways about Masonry's hocus-pocus on the web, television, and the movies that lodges tell petitioners not to peek, or they'll spoil the fun. The Order's main manual used to be Duncan's Ritual, published in 1866. Today it's Freemason for Dummies by Christopher Hodapp, published in 2005. We've got an explosion of openness, says Mr. Hodapp, and it started, face it, in a panic over membership. A generation of joiners home from war boosted Masonic rolls in America to 4 million by 1959, but in the 1960s hippies were turned off by the establishment mysticism. When the sons of hippies asked about Freemasonry's secrets, their boomer dads didn't have a clue. By the mid-2000s, fewer than 2 million members remained. Faced with a choice between going extinct and going public, the Masons went public. The order has no central authority, but Grand Lodges in several states put up billboards, ran TV commercials, and staged mass rituals, initiating hundreds of men at a time. Mr. Hodapp calls that a travesty. Many initiates never showed up. Many that did, he wrote in an internal paper, found a desperate group of aging members and endless meetings about bill paying, bad food, and who is going to iron the degree uniforms. But some of those young apprentices stayed on. Though total membership is down to 1.4 million, losses to death and dullness have erased to 30,000 a year from 80,000. The hook may have less to do with Masonry itself than with pop culture's fascination with it. Masonic myths often play the lead on the History Channel, in movies like National Treasure, and in Dan Brown's bestsellers, especially his Masonry-laced 2009 novel, The Lost Symbol. That book, it was real catalyst for us, Reed Endersby said one day at his Redstone Temple in Minneapolis. He is 40, program director at Rock Station and master of a lodge number 19, where a lot of us like that bond with the movers and shakers of the globe. His lodge has 60 active members, 300 in all, and is adding more, most between 21 and 35. Nobody invites them, they just hit the website's Contact Us button. Each pays $450 for a ceremonial degree, tux required, dues of $300 a year, plus extra for co-ed paintball fights, cigar rolling shows, and scotch tastings. The Sacred Order of Scotch Knights cracked number 19's 26-year-old senior warden, Adam Martin, as he and some brothers walked to a pizza place down the street. Mr. Endersby pushed up a sleeve to exhibit his own devotion to Scottish Knights, a Templar cross tattoo. The warrior monks of the Knights Templar probably didn't hide as stoneworkers after the Pope excommunicated them in 1307. Mr. Endersby has fun thinking they did. Then again, his lodge does get petitions from headcases, as he puts it, eager to enlist in the Masonic satanic conspiracy that's so well detailed now on the web. They usually take out a $1 bill, he says, and connect the letters and the all-seeing eye to spell a Mason. Conspiracists will argue that only the inner circles know what the order is truly up to. But when Matt Gallagher joined Braden Lodge over in St. Paul, he did it for three reasons. I wanted to become a better person. I like retro stuff. And I'm a big believer in guys hanging out and talking with other guys. Down in Braden's meeting room on fellowship night, a dozen guys had pushed three tables together and were passing a coffee pot. Seven were under 36. They were trying something new, a philosophical discourse. The theme was, where do morals come from? If your best friend commits treason, do you turn him in? Someone asked. A discussion followed. Someone else asked, if Hitler walked in front of your car, do you hit the gas? More discussion. Brian Silverain, a laid-off teacher with a tie-dye shop, asked Mr. Gallagher at one point, "Do you like who you are?" Mr. Gallagher replied, "I don't know who I am, and I don't like that." Cell phones started to ring after 2 hours, wives wondering where their husbands were. "Well, I guess we kicked that morality dog around enough," said Harvey Holmes, who is 52 and sells insurance. The crowd thinned. After midnight, talk turned to ghosts, then moved on to lutefisk recipes. Potato chips were retrieved from the kitchen. At 1:15, three of the guys were still left in the temple of their ancient and mystic order, still hanging out and still talking. This week's famous Freemason is Warren Gamaliel Harding, November 2, 1865 to August 2, 1923. Was the 29th president of the United States, 1921 to 1923, a Republican from Ohio. Harding was an influential self-made newspaper publisher. He served in the Ohio Senate from 1899 to 1903 as the 28th Lieutenant Governor of Ohio, 1904 to 1906, and as a U.S. Senator from 1915 to 1921. He was also the first incumbent United States Senator and the first newspaper publisher to be elected president. His conservatism, affable manner, and make no enemies campaign strategy made Harding the compromise choice at the 1920 Republican National Convention. During his presidential campaign in the aftermath of World War I, he promised a return of the nation to normalcy. This America First campaign encouraged industrialization and a strong economy independent of foreign influence. Harding departed from the progressive movement that had dominated Congress since President Theodore Roosevelt. In the 1920 election, he and his running mate, Calvin Coolidge, defeated Democrat and fellow Ohioan James M. Cox in the largest presidential popular vote landslide in American history, 60.36% to 34.19%, since popular vote totals were first recorded in 1824. President Harding rewarded friends and political contributors referred to as the Ohio Gang with financially powerful positions. Scandals and corruption, including the notorious Teapot Dome scandal, eventually pervaded his administration. One of his own cabinet and several of his own appointees were eventually tried, convicted, and sent to prison for bribery or defrauding the federal government. Harding did, however, make some notably positive appointments to his cabinet. In foreign affairs, Harding spurned the League of Nations and signed a separate peace treaty with Germany and Austria, formally ending World War I. He also strongly promoted world naval disarmament at the 1921-1922 Washington Naval Conference and urged U.S. participation in a proposed international court. Domestically, Harding signed the first child welfare program in the United States and dealt with striking workers in the mining and railroad industries. Also, the Veterans Bureau was cleaned up by Harding in March 1923. The nation's unemployment rate dropped by half during Harding's administration. In August 1923, President Harding suddenly collapsed and died during a stop in California on a return trip from Alaska. He was succeeded by Vice President Calvin Coolidge. Historians have traditionally been resistant to giving Harding good presidential reviews due to his multiple federal department scandals during his administration. As a result, Harding has received low rankings as president. His reputation, however, has increased among some historians for his conservative financial policies, fiscal responsibility, and his endorsement of African American civil rights. Harding's creation of a budget bureau was a major economic accomplishment that reformed and streamlined wasteful federal spending. In 1998, journalist Carl S. Anthony stated Harding was a modern figure who embraced technology and culture, sensitive to the plights of minorities, women, and labor. President Harding contended with racial problems on a national level rather than sectional and openly advocated African-American political education and economic equality inside the Solid South. The Masonic Record, he was initiated June 28, 1901 in Marion Lodge No. 70, Marion, Ohio. Because of some personal antagonism, Brother Harding's advancement was hindered until 1920, by which time he had been nominated for president. Friends persuaded the opposition to withdraw the objection, and on August 27, 1920, 19 years after his initiation, Brother Harding achieved the sublime degree of Master Mason in Marion Lodge. At his request, Brother Harding took the oath of office of President of the United States upon the same Bible as he was used by Brother George Washington for the same purpose on April 30, 1789, the Altar Bible of St. John's Lodge No. 1 in New York City. In June 1923, Harding set out on a westward cross-country voyage of understanding in which he planned to renew his connection with the people. away from the Capitol and explain his policies. The trip was scheduled to include 18 speeches, innumerable informal talks, and accompanying him were Secretaries Work, Wallace, and Hoover, House Speaker Gillette, and Rear Admiral Adam Hugh Rodman. During this trip, he became the first president to visit Alaska. Harding's physical health had been declining since the fall of 1922. One doctor, Emanuel Libman, who had met Harding at a dinner, privately suggested that the president was suffering from coronary disease. By early 1923, Harding had trouble sleeping, looked tired, and could barely get through 9 holes of golf. Although Harding desired to run for a second term in office, he may have been aware of his own health decline. He gave up drinking, sold his life work, the Marion Star, in part to regain $170,000 in previous investment losses, and had the U.S. Attorney General Harry Doughty make a new will. Harding, along with his personal physician, Dr. Charles E. Sawyer, believed getting away from Washington would help relieve the stress of being president. By July 1923, criticism of Harding's administration had been increasing. Prior to leaving Washington, the president was noted for having chest pains radiating down his left arm. And we know what happened after that. Well, that's it for this week. Remember to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at WentzCamu, and email us and add us to your circle on Google+ at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Pinterest under the WCY Podcast. Visit the website at wcypodcast.blogspot.com for links to all of those and more, including YouTube and Vimeo channels. Also, links to the apps, which let you listen streaming instead of syncing. Until next week, be safe and have a great week. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.